drawing. Hear ye. All manner of persons having anything to bring before the Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the Honorable Court.
Good morning, Council. Ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Springfield, Justice Berger. Your Honors, we're here this morning to discuss the case of Larry Johnson versus the State of Delaware. As you're, I'm sure, aware, this was a capital murder case where the verdict came back. Mr. Johnson is not facing the death penalty. There is an issue that I would like to address just very briefly. I raised four in the appeal. The most insignificant was that of the screen that was found by the police officer sometime 18 months after the incident in question. The objection was made, and the argument was based on an insufficient foundation to allow the screen into evidence. I would like at this point in time to just state that if even you were to find for Mr. Johnson on that issue, we would concede that it would be harmless error, that the introduction of that screen in the overall context of this case would have been was insignificant, even though it did support somewhat supported the testimony of Trevanian Norton. The other issues, I believe, are more intertwined and of more importance. During the course of this trial, either right before or during the course, the United States Supreme Court decided the issue of Crawford v. Washington. This impacted on two specific witnesses in this particular case, in the opinion of the appellant. One, the accomplice or co-defendant, Trevanian Norton, but more importantly, Ms. Warner. I would first like to deal with Trevanian Norton. My objection to Trevanian Norton's dealt specifically with one area. That was the area of the alleged or the undisputed threat that the co-defendant, Mr. Cole, made to Trevanian Norton. The state indicates correctly that there was an instruction given, and at no time did the state ever indicate that that threat was made by Mr. Johnson. The defense, however, contends that any time you have a joint trial, any statement or any threat made by one implicates both defendants. The trial judge in this particular case said that the defense was arguing guilt by association. The answer to that is yes, we were. And it's our argument that that was not permitted. It's similar to the case in Lilly versus Virginia, where you had the confrontation issue between the co-defendant and the person on trial. There was not a joint trial there. This court looked at that in Barrow v. State, when the co-defendant in that case, coincidentally also named Larry Johnson, refused to testify, and yet a statement indicating that he was just a lookout was allowed into evidence. This court in that basically took the position that can't consider that the jury, I don't know the proper word there, but the jury is not stupid. Why is the state putting this evidence in if it is not to implicate the defendants? Following that theory here, now clearly again, they said, Cole said this, it was Cole that said this, it was Cole that made the threat. But Cole is not on trial by himself. Cole is on trial with Johnson. The state's going to argue accomplice liability. Does not the fact that Cole made a threat come back to Johnson? The answer to that is yes. Now, to the extent that there's any hearsay exceptions to that.
Well, how does it come back to Johnson?
Because they're a trial. If in an insulated instance where I'm talking to Trevanian Norton, there's no implication as to anyone else, it doesn't. But you've got the argument that three people committed this crime. One being Trevanian Norton, one being Donald Cole, one being Larry Johnson. Now, is Donald Cole making this threat to protect himself only? Or is he protecting both himself and Larry Johnson? And the argument would be he's protecting both Johnson and Cole. He's protecting himself. If you tell about Johnson, if you tell about me, watch out for your children. We know you have children. That threat by Cole is admission not only as to Cole, but as to Johnson. Because they're being tried together, and it alleged that they did this together.
Perhaps I should know the answer to this, but did he say, we know you have children?
He did not say we, I'm sorry. That may be a mistake on my part. I believe the word we was not used, Your Honor. I think if it was used, it would be a much clearer...
Would have been clearer to me anyway.
Yes. Unfortunately, the word we, I don't believe was used. I'd like to now go on to what I think is in this particular case, the key issue and the key witness, and that is Miss Bessie Warner. To understand Miss Warner's significance, we have to take a look at the overall case and how the state determined to present it and how the defense chose to defend it. From the briefing and from what you've read, I'm sure it's obvious that Donald Cole was involved in a robbery shooting approximately a few weeks before the murders took place. Similar type of a operation. That's what was referred to as the Lancaster Avenue incident. During that incident, a person was shot, two people were shot, and a piece of jewelry was taken. Mr. Cole was charged and pled guilty to that crime. During the course of the trial, also charged in that crime was one Elwood Hunter. The importance of that is Elwood Hunter was identified by the victim of that crime, April Charles, as the person that shot her. What may not be in this transcript is that during the course of that Lancaster Avenue trial, Donald Cole came forward. And I'll put this, so you're eventually going to get it, hear all this when you get Donald Cole's case. Donald Cole comes forward and says, Elwood Hunter was not involved. It was Larry Johnson. And Larry Johnson was also with me at 23rd Street. Larry Johnson never went to trial on 1348 Lancaster Avenue. He was charged, and the prior to trial, the indictment was dismissed. We then get to trial, and the state, because of ballistics, wants to link Lancaster Avenue with the 23rd Street with the 23rd Street murders. The defense did not object. In fact, we adopted that as our defense. Larry Johnson was not at Lancaster Avenue. Therefore, Larry Johnson was not at 23rd Street. We don't care what Trevanian Norton said. He wasn't there. That was our defense at trial. That was our defense we were consistent with. The state in rebuttal, and strike that for a second. We had April Charles come forward at trial. April Charles testified about 1348 Lancaster Avenue. She testifies about what happened, who was there, and that in fact Larry Johnson was not involved. The state in rebuttal brings forward one, Bessie Warner. Bessie Warner had been incarcerated in Connecticut. It was clear she didn't want to be here. We object to her testimony coming in under Crawford, because before we did that, she took the stand. She says she doesn't remember giving a statement to the police. She doesn't recall saying anything to the police. She doesn't recall any specifics about the conversations or what she told the police. She does have some indication about remembering a piece of jewelry that Mr. Johnson gave to Donald Cole, and she does remember Donald Cole and Larry Johnson talking in front of her house. But she specifically does not recall any conversation with Detective Chafin. We then have voir dire. I'm sorry, this was voir dire. We then have the inserts of the tape played for. Jury's not there. Does she recall anything after that? No, she still doesn't remember the statement. She still doesn't remember talking to the police officer. However, the judge allows the statement to come in under 3507. Now, the state's argument is that under 3507, it is allowed to come in because 3507 was in fact drafted for the sole purpose of aiding the state in turncoat witnesses. And we agree with that. The issue is not whether that's why it was drafted. The issue is whether that should be permissible under Crawford v. Washington. Now, I would like to say that Crawford v. Washington outlaws 3507 altogether. I can't say that because specifically it footnotes that it doesn't apply to testimonial statements given outside of the presence of court where the person is available for trial testimony. Ms. Warner was in fact available, or was at, for testimony. The issue was she available for cross-examination on the 3507 statement. Clearly she was not available when there was no cross-examination when the statement was made. The issue becomes, can you effectively cross-examine someone on a 3507 statement when that person has no recollection of making the statement, does not recall why she said what was on the statement, and in essence you're putting this before a jury and saying, this is what she told the police officer, this is the truth, don't believe her when she says she doesn't remember anything. The issue is, I've got to be able to cross-examine her on that statement, not cross-examine her on the witness stand.
Well, there's a more difficult issue, I think. We have at least one case, the name of which unfortunately escapes me, where the out-of-court declarant who was offered in the 3507 suffered from amnesia. and the court ruled that, so what? They were available for cross-examination. So if your point is, what does it mean to be available for cross-examination, and that you must read effective cross-examination into that, the broader difficulty is, this is a statute. This is not a court rule. This is a statement of public policy by the legislature. Unless there's some constitutional issue that you can articulate that makes this statute unconstitutional, either under the United States Constitution or the Delaware Constitution, what could we do about it?
Your Honor,
even if we were sympathetic to your view.
The issue is, putting it that way, is what is the definition of unavailability? Defense would have you adopt the theory that unavailability means unavailable for effective cross-examination. Now,
well, let's can I twist that
sure.
for a moment? Let's pose the issue as, what is availability? The solution to the hearsay problem, according to the policy of the statute, is the presence of the witness who made the statement on the stand available for cross-examination. So I think the way you articulate the issue is, can you effectively cross-examine someone who has no memory, or at least purports to have no memory of ever having made the statement, and think in the back of your mind about the case where the person clearly had amnesia and there was no way you were going to refresh the recollection of that witness by way of cross-examination, yet that passed muster. So I don't want to detract you from your line of thinking, but it seems to me the focus should be on, is this witness really available for cross-examination?
Correct. I'll agree with that. Going back to the person with amnesia, if my recollection is correct, there was a reliability issue there. What made that statement reliable? Crawford basically says reliability is out the door. That reliability has no basis. The whole issue is, did the defendant have the right for effective cross-examination? Now, and I understand both issues here. And I think it boils down to, does our Constitution say that we are to protect, is our Constitution meant to protect the rights of the defendant as opposed to the duties or goals of the state? Now, 3507 clearly does not aid a defendant.
Why not? In an appropriate case. Couldn't you use a 3507 during a defense case?
Yes, you could.
Well, then it can aid a defendant.
I guess I misspoke. 3507, yes, definitely can come in because it is not governed by the same rule that the state has under Crawford. And I think Crawford specifically stated that in fact this did not affect the right of the defendant to use an out-of-court testimonial statement. But the issue again, could we effectively cross-examine Bessie Warner? And could we yes, we could effectively cross-examine her to some extent, but could we effectively cross-examine her as to what was on the 3507 statement? The answer to that was no, because she couldn't remember it.
You've got just a little over a minute and a half left.
The last
statement, or do you want to finish?
One last thing I want to say, Your Honor, and it's probably best said now, I'll say it quickly. That was the issue of the jewelry being admitted into evidence. There is absolutely nothing in the record, nothing, that ties that appraisal, that picture of the jewelry, to this trial. Absolutely nothing. Yes, Bessie Warner says this is the appraisal that I got from the jewelry that Larry Johnson gave to Donald Cole. But there's nothing in this trial that says that piece of jewelry came from Lancaster Avenue. Nothing. And that's important because the state had to put, based on the defense, we rose, the state has to put Larry Johnson at Lancaster Avenue. How did they put Larry Johnson at Lancaster Avenue? That piece of jewelry. And yet, that piece of jewelry was never linked by anyone to that, not by April Charles, not by Donald Cole, not by Larry Johnson. It was linked merely because Detective Chafin said, this is the appraisal that I got from her. And any evidence that may have come in the other trial that was used to aid the judge in the ruling should not have been used in this trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goodell.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Berger, Justice Richley. May it please the court, I'll attempt to address the issues in the order that they appeared in the brief, since it looks to me like they've covered all the various issues in some fashion here. Basically, what we're talking about is a series of evidentiary rulings by the Superior Court judge in this joint trial of Mr. Johnson and Mr. Cole for first-degree murder charges. This was a home invasion with a double homicide here. The first issue concerns whether or not the trial judge abused her discretion in admitting Donald Cole, who was Mr. Johnson's co-defendant's threat against the state's witness, and he was the primary state witness, I guess, in this case, Mr. Norton. The exact language that was used, since that question arose, was it's at page A22 of the appendix to the opening brief, and it says, what did Mr. Cole say to you? This is a direct examination of Mr. Norton, and he says, he told me, you know, your son was just born, keep your mouth shut, and that's the sum total of the statement there. It's very brief, and it says he refers to Mr. Cole. There's some preparatory questions about whether or not there was a conversation with Mr. Cole. So I think it's very clear from the context, as well as what is said, that it's simply a statement made by Mr. Cole, and it's only being admitted against Mr. Cole in this case. The trial judge pointed that out to defense counsel when the objection was made, that it was not guilt by association, as she characterized it, but simply something that was admissible as to one defendant, but not admissible as to another. There was no other use made by the state to attempt to implicate Mr. Johnson, and under those particular circumstances, it wasn't an abuse of discretion to admit that particular evidence here. I'm not even sure that it's actually even hearsay. It's been characterized as hearsay, but I think if it's an admission by a party opponent, that's an express exception to the general hearsay rule. If it is hearsay, then it probably falls under the exception of a statement against interest in this particular case. The second issue concerns the rebuttal witness, Bessie Warner, and I think it's important to remember the context of her testimony. She actually appeared as a rebuttal witness for the prosecution after Mr. Johnson had taken the stand and testified and denied any involvement in either the earlier Lancaster Avenue home invasion where the ring was taken, or the subsequent case, which was actually the one at trial involving the home on 23rd Street in Wilmington where the double homicide occurred. He denied any involvement in either particular case. Mr. Cole did not testify, the co-defendant. Ms. Warner was brought in as a prosecution rebuttal witness, and the reason that this person was brought in was to testify concerning a conversation she had overheard in 2001 that had occurred between Johnson and Cole. She was inside a house, and I think she said the two defendants were outside the house, but she was near a window or the window was open, and she could overhear at least what was being said. They were discussing a robbery and a shooting. Presumably, this had to do with the earlier August 22nd home invasion at Lancaster Avenue where April Charles and another individual were shot, not fatally, but they were shot during that home invasion.
Now, just so I'm clear, she said this in her statement or she said this in her testimony at trial?
I think it gets a little confusing as to what she says at trial. She says at trial that she overhears a conversation, but she can't remember what the substance is in her trial testimony. And then I think the state interrupts her trial testimony and brings in Detective Chafin to introduce what she had told him earlier about that. I think she had made a statement in December 2001. This trial actually occurs in July of 2004. And I think it's through Detective Chafin's testimony relating her earlier statement that you find out the substance of what it is that she hears. And the substance is that they were talking about a robbery and a shooting. And I don't think it's identified any more specifically than that. They don't say a robbery or a shooting at Lancaster Avenue or anything like that. It's just a generic robbery and shooting. She overhears this conversation. She also testifies in rebuttal that she receives a ring from Mr. Cole and that Mr. Cole had received that ring from Mr. Johnson. And she affirms in her rebuttal testimony at the trial that upon Mr. Cole's instruction, she takes the ring to Littman Jewelers. And I think the appraisal becomes important because of the date. The date on that shows a written appraisal on September 1st of 2001, and that would have been 9 or 10 days after the August 22 Lancaster Avenue home invasion. So I think while Mr. Johnson's counsel's right that there isn't a definitive conclusive link, it is circumstantial in this case. In other words, they're discussing a robbery and a shooting. There is a robbery and a shooting that's occurred at Lancaster Avenue on August 22nd. There's this ring that was taken. There is an appraisal for the ring that's done on September 1, 9 or 10 days afterwards. The appraisal also has a photograph of the ring. Now, what the state didn't do, and I'm not really sure why, but they didn't recall April Charles to the stand and rebuttal and have her identify that photograph of the ring as in fact, her wedding ring that was taken. She testified that her platinum wedding ring that had 11 diamonds in it was taken. But she is never shown the photograph, as far as I can tell, from the trial record to identify that, oh, yes, that's my ring. So
was Ms. Warner asked to identify the ring by photograph?
I don't know if she was or not.
It was given to her, and she's the one that took it for the appraisal.
And then I think what the way that's tied, and I believe is through Detective Chafin, and he testifies, I think he talks to her three different times, and I think it's on the second occasion that she mentions an appraisal being done, and they go upstairs, and Detective Chafin says that he gets the appraisal at that point in time and takes custody of the appraisal that has the photograph, but I don't know that anybody definitively identifies the ring in there. So all we really have, I guess, is circumstantial evidence here, but circumstantial evidence is still admissible in this particular case. I think Warner's testimony is certainly admissible here. It's admissible under Section 3507, and it's been pointed out at least one of the reasons.
You said the photograph was admitted?
Yes, the photograph, I think, comes in as part of the appraisal. There's a.
And does it match the testimony of the owner of the ring?
I don't know. I haven't seen the photograph. I'm not sure if it does or doesn't. I don't recall anything in the record where somebody says or argues to the jury that, no, it doesn't. You know, this isn't a platinum wedding ring and it doesn't have 11 diamonds. See, it only has 6 or whatever. I don't recall anything like that. So, I mean, I'm assuming it does, but that's just purely an assumption on my part. But 3507, it's certainly part of the genesis of that statute is that it's designed for a turncoat witness. The case that the Chief Justice was referring to, I think, is the 1984 decision in Burke. And Burke was a case where In fact, the witness, the prosecution witness, had been involved in a very serious motor vehicle accident and had been thrown through the windshield of the car and sustained some sort of a neurological injury. And she was suffering from amnesia, that it wasn't just one of these soap opera things, that she generally couldn't remember things. And she apparently had known the defendant, Mr. Burke, before all of the charges had arisen, but was unable to identify him in the courtroom, and it did appear that she was generally suffering from amnesia. So I think what the Burke case points out, as well as the other similar type decisions that I've cited at page 18 of the answering brief, Damone Flowers, which was recently decided by this court, and Pedro Cintro, is that you don't necessarily have to have any specific quality of cross-examination. That 3507 and the Confrontation Clause doesn't guarantee that you're going to have effective cross-examination. It simply guarantees that you're going to have an opportunity to attempt to cross-examine the individual as best you can in this particular instance. I don't think it's quite as problematic when you have tape statements. At least the jury can hear, or in the case of Damone Flowers, I think it was actually a videotape when Ms. Settler didn't recall making the prior statement. The jury was able to look at the videotape and say, well, that certainly looks like the witness, and she's talking, and, you know, she's answering questions from the police officer, so, you know, she must have made this statement. And that's the important thing under 3507, is that there's three criteria. You have to have the witness somehow touch upon the statement, although it becomes much more difficult when the witness simply says they can't remember ever making the statement. The statement has to be shown to be voluntary, and the person who made the statement has to be presented and be subject to cross-examination. And those three criteria were satisfied here. The trial judge, during the trial, the objection about Mr. Norton's proposed testimony came up on the first day of trial. The second day of trial, in July of 2004, the judge, sua sponte, had raised the issue about Crawford versus Washington, a March 8, 2004 decision of the United States Supreme Court, and what impact, if any, it had in this particular case. And the state's position is that Crawford versus Washington, while it's not completely clear what the parameters are, it does not extend to all hearsay evidence. It does not exclude all hearsay evidence. Crawford says that explicitly. The more problematic issue is they talk about testimonial evidence and things like that, but they don't really tell you exactly what testimonial is. There's a listing in the Crawford versus Washington decision of three different formulations, as the U.S. Supreme Court characterizes it, of what is testimonial evidence here, and they give some different examples under each of the three criteria, but they don't explicitly say that, you know, we're adopting the second criteria or the first or the third. So I think that's certainly an open issue and will probably have to be decided at some point in the future. But here, I don't think we're talking about evidence that could reasonably be construed as testimonial in nature. It's simply a private conversation between Johnson and Cole that is overheard by another person, Bessie Warner, and to an extent, I guess, that the police officer is relating it. It's hearsay or maybe even double hearsay. But that can still be admissible because if it falls within one of the hearsay exceptions, it's permissible. And if you're talking about involvement in a robbery or a burglary, those are certainly statements against interest or admissions by party opponents, which aren't hearsay at all under our evidentiary rules. So I don't think Crawford versus Washington changes the result at all in this particular case, given the nature of the testimony. The window screen, I think, was properly authenticated and met the test under 901. The important thing, even though the officer didn't go get this window screen for 17 or 18 months, and I guess the delay was attributable to the fact that this was an unsolved homicide for quite a while, and it was only after Detective Chapin spoke with Mr. Norton, who was incarcerated on some other drug charges, that the police were able to solve this particular crime. And it was at that point that Chafin realized, I guess, that there may be some evidentiary significance to the screen. So he goes back to the scene of the homicide, I think it's 17 or 18 months later, picks up the screen. Now, the importance of how the state is able to show that this is, in fact, the same window screen. The prosecutor made a representation, which the trial judge accepted, that some other relatives of the decedents had been living in the house there, so it was still generally under the authority of family members. And the second and more important thing was that there were some distinctive characteristics about the window screen. There were two little slits or cuts near the bottom where Mr. Cole had cut through the screen in order to remove it and gain access through the second floor rear window. In addition, Detective Chafin pointed out that there was a black fingerprint powder residue that was still present on the screen, even though 17 or 18 months had passed. The screen had been dusted for fingerprints at the time of the homicide in August of 2001, but no latent prints of any significance had been found at that time. But nonetheless, there was still, at least according to Detective Chafin's testimony, some fingerprint residue, this black powder, that was detectable. So those two physical characteristics, the slits or cuts in the screen, and the black powder residue, was sufficient authentication to allow that evidence to be presented. All the screen really did was confirm Mr. Norton's testimony that that's how access was gained to the house, that Mr. Cole got on a porch roof and was able to get in through the second floor window. So the screen, while it had some importance, was probably not a crucial piece of evidence in any event in this case. I've already talked a little bit about the appraisal and the appraisal receipt. I think those were also properly admissible in this particular case, and that there was not any abuse of discretion, that the combination of Bessie Warner's reluctant trial testimony, as has already been pointed out, she was incarcerated in Connecticut on other charges, and she conceded that she had been Donald Cole's girlfriend, and in fact they had a child together, and she really didn't want to be there. She candidly admitted that as well. But I think the combination of her testimony and her prior statement as related by Detective Chafin was sufficient to have this appraisal admitted. It was unfortunate, I guess, for the state that they didn't also recall April Charles to ever identify the photograph as in fact being her ring, but that's the state of the evidence at this point. If there's any questions, I'll attempt to answer those.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.